Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is retired British Army Brigadier Ben Barry, the Land Warfare Fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, who is the author of the new book, Blood, Metal, and Dust, How Victory Turned into Defeat in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's a veteran, or as he puts it, a walk-on actor in the conflicts in Northern Ireland, the Balkans, and Afghanistan. He also did a stint with the illustrious British Brigade in Hong Kong before the handover to China. And this is his third book, The Others, The Road from Sarajevo, British Army Operations in Bosnia, 1995 to 1996, and Harsh Lessons, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Changing Character of War. Ben, thanks very much for joining us. It's always an honor.
It's a pleasure to be here, Vago. Now, how can I help?
You've put together an extraordinary book on strategy. It's a follow-on to the work that you've done. You obviously worked this issue when you were in the British Army in the Ministry of Defense doing lessons learned work. But before we get started, I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsors. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine, our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. As I was saying, your book comes at a very, very important time as nations, particularly Washington, but also the UK, France, Germany, Australia, Japan, everybody else are shifting their focus to great power competition, and in part want to be sort of done with these sort of small wars, if you will, these gray wars, these sort of hybrid conflicts. At the same time, the British Ministry of Defense and the Johnson administration are doing a defense review. There'll be more spending, but decisions will have to be made in that context. The future of tanks is one of the questions that are being assessed. And these are all topics that you tackle in the book. One of the key takeaways from the book is that we got into trouble because we lacked both clear strategy on what we wanted to achieve in both of these wars. But then we also did smaller things like get rid of counterinsurgency training that came back to bite us. One of the key lessons worth remembering is that we may not want to fight these kind of wars that are counterinsurgency or gray zone, but we may have no choice in the matter ultimately, especially given that China and Russia want to fight these kind of gray zone conflicts. From your standpoint, what are sort of the key strategic lessons from both of these conflicts that are worth remembering as we go into a great power focus in our strategy?
That's a very good question, Vago. It seems to me that one of the reasons the US and its allies, particularly the UK, struggled in both wars is because on the first half of both wars, they were trying to fight a war that they'd imagined they wanted to fight. But they weren't actually fighting the war that their enemies were trying to fight. So they created a disconnect for themselves. If you add to this a predisposition in Washington, D.C., an aversion to nation building, although nation building is what they had to do, and that the U.S. Army particularly had previously walked away from counterinsurgency, no wonder they had difficulty formulating an adequate strategy.
And why was that, right? Because you point out that it was sometime into the wars going exceptionally badly where it seemed to dawn on people, wow, we really didn't think this through and there were really big stakes. I mean, aren't these sort of fundamental questions that should be asked up front? I mean, it is a little bit, and I think you quote President Obama in this, right? Don't do stupid shit. It should be, or stupid stuff should be your sort of guiding focus when you're before you get into something.
Yeah, I think what you've got, particularly in Washington, D.C., is you've also got a leadership of defense in terms of Secretary Rumsfeld and many of his key subordinates who've been mesmerized by the revolution in military affairs. And of course, aspects of the revolution in military affairs had been very successful in the very innovative campaign in Afghanistan, where the CIA and Army Special Forces were supported by precision air power, and they acted as a force multiplier for the militias of the Northern Alliance. And of course, in the invasion of Iraq, the first part of Operation Iraqi Freedom, you had very highly networked forces, very modernized, superbly trained and equipped, that defeated much less modernized and much less well-trained forces. You then got the impact of the aversion to nation building, which the leadership, the US military leadership takes as it has the effect of not applying adequate forces to stabilize Iraq and particularly Afghanistan. And you then get some very well documented poor initial decisions, allowing the looting in Iraq, disbanding the military, disbanding the Ba'ath Party and kicking all members out onto the street. If you add to that the failures of the US and its allies to rapidly reconstruct Iraq, particularly to get the electricity back up and running, and then the widely reported prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib, you've got ordinary Iraqis asking the question, how come this country that put a man on the moon can't put the power on in Baghdad and Basra? And all sorts of conspiracy theories quickly rise, all of which is amplified by Al Jazeera. And neither the US political messages nor their military's attempt to do information operations are nearly powerful enough to counter these very powerful negative narratives. But I think President Obama was absolutely right. For various reasons, the US and its allies in Iraq ended up doing very stupid things. Now, such was the effect of the Iraq war on the legitimacy of the US and the UK that it actually contaminated the legitimacy of the war in Afghanistan. So many NATO and European countries that actually in 2002 had really wanted to help with the effort in Afghanistan, because of this contamination of the legitimacy of what the US was doing in Afghanistan, they found it much more difficult to wholeheartedly support the US in Afghanistan than they might have done.
In both of these wars, for all the focus that they had, we were positively lumbering, right? I mean, had we fought World War II this way, we would have lost World War II, right? We didn't have the strategy. There was clarity of strategy in World War II. We didn't have the force size. We were reluctant to increase forces. We didn't want to field equipment. We debated some things. Some things moved very, very quickly. Tactics, some good, some not. Took us a while to get to the surge. Once we got to the surge, we implemented it. But then we were bribing people at the end of the day, right? For all. So, I mean, the strategic progression was slow. World War II would have been over by the time we did this. In any future crisis, in a great power crisis especially, things are going to be much more complicated. We're going to be moving much, much more quickly. What are the lessons we can derive from these two conflicts that either can help us improve decision-making or speed lessons we need to learn about how you get to better outcomes faster, or if you get to a bad outcome, you at least do it faster on the road to learning more quickly and getting it right?
Varga, there's a couple of points there. I commend to the audience Robert Gates's autobiography, particularly a chapter called My War with the Pentagon. And in it, he explains how he found that although the US was engaged in two wars that it wasn't winning, much of the Pentagon and much of the service departments were not on a war footing. They lacked a sense of urgency and they wanted to continue with business as usual. And you can tell that Gates was especially frustrated with the US Air Force that in his view was not fielding unmanned aerial vehicles as quickly as enough. But a lot of this is strategic leadership and it boils down to the head of government and his inner circle of security makers. In Washington, D.C., it's the members of the National Security Council. I think there's plenty of independent evidence about how intelligence was misread and mishandled, not just in the US, but also in the UK, Australia, and other countries. But it does show you that you need to be professional about intelligence, and it needs to constantly be tested. I think also you've got to have a systematic process for decision-making, and that process itself has got to have within it a degree of challenge and testing. And there's also got to be some form of very rigorous assessment where the strategic decision maker can see if what they've decided to do is actually working. And in my book, I set out in some detail how Prime Minister Tony Blair consistently failed to achieve this with regard to British decision making for the stabilization of Iraq. I think you've also got to have in your security machinery, you've got to have people who are prepared to tell truth to power. And you've got to be very careful about not having a bias towards optimism. And certainly the British Independent Iraq Inquiry has plenty of jaw-dropping examples of over-optimistic briefing, including over-optimistic briefing by named defense ministers and truth not being told to power.
So going into Iraq, for example, and even in Afghanistan, there was talk about rebuilding, and even though we didn't do any of it in Afghanistan, right? I mean, the focus very rapidly shifted from Afghanistan to, you know, we won, we declared victory, then we went to Iraq. And there, in the initial stages to try to sell the war or the coming war, it was, we're going to get everything right. You know, the Treasury Department is working, tax policy, and, you know, all of this stuff. And it ended up all really being for naught. I mean, the plan was going there, win. And then there wasn't much of a plan to do anything. And then we sort of waffled along for another number of years, and in fact, reaping bitter fruit from it. You know, you talk about Maliki's role, for example, in all of that, which I think was important. One of the things that we have talked about is, okay, how do we get better at this? How do we better integrate the arms of diplomacy and economics and all of these other things? And you note that Russia and especially Iran have repeatedly demonstrated a far more integrated approach to advancing their interests. You know, if your enemy has a good idea, Ben, it's always best to steal them. What can we learn from Russia and especially Iran on how they're more joined up in shaping conflict, but also shaping peace?
Well, it's all to do with putting together a comprehensive strategy that covers all levers of power. So it's what is often referred to in DC as interagency. Now, Russia has a national command center in which all organs of government are represented, and it has a strategic operations room. Of course, it is an autocracy, but it's sometimes been quite a successful autocracy. Stalin, for example, was very good at doing this in the second half of the Second World War. I think in the case of the US, Title 10 does not help. And this is where the UK has one small advantage over the US. There is no Title 10, and the British government has increasingly made use of shared pots of money. For example, the peacekeeping and operations it does in Africa come from an interagency pot of shared money against which the government departments bid. So by having shared sums of money, you can help foster collaborative behavior. They also have, the British, something called fusion doctrine, which is basically combined arms doctrine for interagency. And it certainly seems to have worked. They claim, for example, it was the basis of their response to the poisoning of the Skripals in Salisbury. But I think we have to go further. And I think this is where we have to learn from the bad guys. I'd start off by saying we should learn from the Taliban, because the Taliban appear to have been more successful at retaining control of areas that they've captured than NATO forces or the Afghan government. Now, the Taliban messaging is very simple. They say they offer two things, security and a quasi-judicial redress of grievances. But it's very, very simple. It's easily messaged. And what's more, it seems to work. And that may be one of the advantages that the Taliban have had in the war in Afghanistan. But I think where the US and its allies should really learn from is Iran, particularly the IRGC's CODS force. In my book, I rate out of all the generals who commanded troops in both theatres and both wars, that the most successful general was General Qasim Soleimani, who until a year ago was commander of Quds Force. Quds Force is a very interesting organization. If it existed in America, it would be called a Standing Interagency Task Force. There's much attention on its soft component. It also does terrorism. It supports terrorists, but it does a whole load more. It does capacity building. It's the organization that helped build Hezbollah. It built up Shia militias in Iraq and also in Syria. It knows how to run supply lines, both conventional supply lines and covert supply lines. It does train, advise, and assist, including under fire. And quite a few Quds Force officers have been killed in operations in Syria. It also has the Tehran government's policy lead for Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, and also Yemen. And often the Iranian ambassadors in those countries are officials of Quds Force. What we've also seen it doing in Syria is propaganda and development operations. In Syria also, it's been able to take conventional Iranian forces under command, including air force units and armed drones. So in a sense, it's a one-stop shop for furthering Iranian strategic aims through a mixture of conventional and unconventional means. Now, the US has once or twice come close to that. And since I wrote the book, there's been a very interesting account published of the CIA's war in Kurdistan from 2002-2003, where the CIA initially had some US soft under their command as they built their networks in Kurdistan. In a very imaginative military move, the US then inserted the 173rd Airborne Brigade by parachute and also flew in a heavy battle group from Europe by C-17. The cooperation was less good. But I think there's a very strong case for taking away the lessons that Iran has been so successful because it's been so good at what we in the West would call the interagency or comprehensive approach, but it's hardwired it.
You were an armored infantry battalion commander, so I should point that out before we go any further into this.
Yeah, I also spent a year with the British cavalry.
That's right. You also have some cavalry in your background. Let's talk briefly about the use of force, or rather the necessity for the overwhelming use of force, which is controversial in Western military circles, right? Democracies have a tendency to want to be very sparing. Used four bullets, not 400, for example. But in some parts of the world, they may resent their leaders. For example, Iraqis resented and absolutely hated Saddam Hussein, but they respected him as being strong. And at the end of the day, shows of force, overwhelming uses of force, can actually be something that is a stabilizing effect, which we have a tendency sometimes of overlooking. In fact, some of the people on the Bush team said the problem with Iraq is, and the problem with Afghanistan was, that they never realized that they were beaten, and that led to problems. I don't want to necessarily get into that side of the debate, but what is the case for the overwhelming use of force you found that actually resolved potential issues rather than exacerbated them, if focused on the right adversary, right? Nobody is making the case kill civilians to kill civilians, right? But sometimes the use of force helped get to a better outcome. Give us some examples.
Well, I think the first example is the US operation to remove the Taliban. And I think great credit goes to the CIA, the Special Operations Forces, and to a certain extent, General Franks and Secretary Rumsfeld in going with that plan. You know, it's easy to forget that the US had no such contingency plan, and a conventional invasion of Afghanistan would have taken some time to spin up and quite possibly been quite difficult. But what you get in that opening round of the war in Afghanistan is overwhelming US air power, utterly destroying those Taliban targets it attacks. And very quickly, the Taliban regime is collapsed. And it's also the case that the militias on the ground are able to pose such a combined threat with the US air power that in the later stages of that campaign, the Taliban start running away. What you also got, an operation that may be little known in the US, but the British-led an international stabilization force in Kabul, which was operating on a peace support mode, and it was definitely in support of President Karzai's Afghan interim administration, but quickly putting a multinational brigade of infantry into the center of Kabul really helped stabilize it and build the confidence of the good guys. I'd also say that in 2002, 2003, 2004, there were a number of cases in Afghanistan where warlords who didn't want to go with the flow of the Afghan government or indeed the US were subtly threatened by the US forces or by NATO in terms of overwhelming shows of force from the air, which changed their behavior from non-cooperative to reluctantly cooperative. Now, there's nothing particularly new about that. That happened several times in the Balkans. And shows of force, you know, played quite an important role in the end game in the US invasion of Panama. I think the other thing is that tactically, time and again, US, British, UK, and NATO lives were saved by the application of superior firepower. We should be under no illusions that the militias and insurgents at times made very determined and very brave attempts to overrun US and British defensive positions in Iraq, but especially in Afghanistan. Now, none of those positions were ever completely overrun. And that's because the British and US troops, for example, in Helmand in 2006 and at Wanat and Kop Keating in eastern Afghanistan, they're able to rapidly summon up overwhelming amounts of artillery, of attack helicopters, and manned and unmanned aircraft. And gosh, that's a model of technological progress, because that's not something that the forebears of some of those British battalions would have been able to do on the Northwest frontier in the 1930s. But without it, and without the satellite and digital communications that held the whole thing together, I have no doubt that several of those isolated bases would have been completely overrun and overwhelmed by the Taliban. It's also the case that overwhelming force can have an important political and propaganda effect. I sometimes wonder, in terms of roads not traveled, what might have happened in 2004 after the Shia uprising had been militarily defeated all over Baghdad, south of Baghdad, and in Basra and Nasiriyah, if actually the US and its allies had reinforced Iraq and clamped down on stability and also reinforced it with development and reconstruction, economic and political initiatives, it might just have been able to turn the corner away from the popular support of the Shia militias. One of the counterfactuals, I think, of the Iraq war.
Lloyd Austin is on track, barring congressional opposition, to become the nation's 28th defense secretary. Talk to us about the British near defeat in Basra, what that battle meant, because you do focus on it, but what it also might mean for US-UK relations, given Austin's involvement in it.
Okay, from 2004 to 2008, the British government failed to make strategy work in southern Iraq. It failed to allocate the resources, and it also allowed its strategy to become increasingly misaligned with that of the US. So when the US decided to surge in 2007, the Brits continued to draw down. And this all nearly came to pieces in Operation Charge of the Knights, when the initial Iraqi attack on Basra failed. And one of the reasons it's failed is because the British had opted out of providing mentor teams, the MITs, in the way that the US Army and Marine Corps had. Now, this is relevant now because General Lloyd Austin was Commander 18 Airborne Corps in Baghdad, and his campaign plan was to reinforce success in the Baghdad belts but then to do major offensive operations in Mosul. He had to put that on hold when he basically had to divert a whole load of air power, ISR, and Mentor teams and attack helicopters and drones down to Basra to rescue the near defeat of the Iraqi army there. And the reason the Iraqi army was nearly defeated was because of all sorts of failures in Basra, in British strategy in Basra, of which there's a whole chapter in the book.
And what was the central strategic failure from your standpoint?
The strategic failure was to allow British strategy to become misaligned with US strategy, which was in part a reflection of the fact that the British failed to mobilize their military resources to the extent that the US had, and also decided to execute a strategic pivot from Iraq to Afghanistan based on assumption that Iraq was going to get better, but Iraq didn't get better, but they still started pivoting resources to Afghanistan. A very interesting battle by a US ally that may not be well known about is Operation Medusa, which was a Canadian-led brigade attack near Kandahar in 2006. The Canadians find themselves fighting very hard against very stubborn Taliban with some quite difficult challenges to overcome. They were helped out by US air power. They were also helped by an Afghan militia raised in a hurry by US special forces. And they also had the challenge of uncertain allies, including the British, who wouldn't commit as much as they wanted, and nearly running out of artillery and cannon ammunition during the battle. It's a very interesting case study, and I cover it at greater length than any other similar battle in both wars.
Were there things that we could have done differently to actually have a better outcome than what we have now, which, you're right, I mean, some people have assailed your title to include victory, saying we didn't have anything that looked like victory anyway, right? Maybe not as bad outcome. And by the way, love the title, fundamental title of the book. Talk to us about in Afghanistan, what are the things that could have been done differently that may have put us in a better position than we find ourselves now, which is eager to get out and the Taliban know it, right? I mean, this is the old statement. We have all the clocks, they have all the time.
The most important thing with regard to Afghanistan would be to have not invaded Iraq. Because if you turn the clock back to 2002, the international community was thoroughly in support of helping Afghanistan out, helping it modernize itself, helping it develop itself, and helping it overcome the dreadful legacy of the generations of war. But Iraq not only undermined the legitimacy of US-led wars, but also it sucked away vast amounts of leadership time, of intellectual bandwidth, of diplomacy, of development, of intelligence assets, of special forces, of everything that could have made a difference. But I think, you know, we were where we were. Perhaps one of the most unhelpful things that happened in Afghanistan was that the US, both the CIA and Special Operations Forces, backed warlords who were malign predators. And if they'd had better awareness and also been looking more closely at these people, they'd have been better off walking away from them. On Iraq, I've used the example that there might have been an opportunity after the defeat of the Shia uprising. There might also have been an opportunity in 2010 to be more hard-nosed with the incumbent Prime Minister Maliki, who was allowed to steal the election. I don't think it's feasible that US troops would have been allowed to stay by the Iraqi parliament. They'd outlived their welcome. But I think the US could have exerted itself more to make it more difficult for Maliki to stage a slow-motion electoral coup.
And let me ask you about the lessons, because you talk about air power, sea power, the powerful capabilities the Marines demonstrated, and also the importance of tanks, which is an important conversation, right? Not just because you're an armored infantry brigade or that you're a cavalryman or have served as a cavalryman. At the end of the day, what are, if you can briefly just walk us through each of these capability areas and what you thought were noteworthy in terms of how they were used or potential lessons from them.
Let me start with heavy armor. The heavy armor of the 3rd ID was absolutely decisive in the march to Baghdad and the capture of Baghdad, particularly by the two very imaginative thunder runs by the 2nd Armored Brigade combat team. It was also decisive in helping the Marines get up to the capital, to the east. It's notable that the Marines did suffer some very sad casualties when their more lightly armed amphibious assault vehicles were hit outside Nasiriyah. The British also were able to make excellent use of heavy armor in their siege of Baghdad, in their siege of Basra. And the key thing was that the Abrams tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, Challenger 2s and Warriors had such good armored protection that almost all rocket propelled grenades that were fired at them were deflected, so they could roam at will in the urban areas. And that continued to be not only a battle-winning capability, but a capability that saved a hell of a lot of US and British lives. So I think the enduring lesson is, if your armor does not have a very high degree of protection, its utility against an enemy that can put up stiff resistance is going to be greatly reduced. Your operations will take longer and you'll take more casualties. Shall I go on to air power?
Yes.
I mentioned
go ahead.
Decisive use for close air support. And there was an ever increasing amount of precision to reduce civilian casualties and collateral damage. It was also increasingly used for intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, both manned and unmanned. It's also the fact that although occasionally aircraft and helicopters were shot down, by and large, the US and its allies had air superiority, and they were able to move a hell of a lot of troops and a hell of a lot of materiel by air, both fixed wing and rotary wing. And without that command of the air, coalition forces would have been at an enormous disadvantage. Coalition forces also had unlimited command of the sea, and they were able to make use of the ports in Kuwait and also Karachi. And we take it for granted, actually, that every year a corps was rotated in and out of Iraq, an amazing achievement. It was also amazing the way in 2004, the 1st Armored Division turned around its rotation and conducted the 1st Armored Division extension campaign against Shia militias south of Baghdad. And I hope I do it justice in the book. A quite remarkable achievement. Sea power was also very useful as a platform for projecting air power. You know, the carrier air power over Iraq and Afghanistan made a considerable difference. And the ability to surge the carrier air power and move the carriers around, I think, was essential. I was also particularly struck by the then Brigadier General Mattis's amphibious operation with his Marine Expeditionary Brigade from the Indian Ocean into the heart of Kandahar province, an 800-mile air insertion, which was, in a sense, something the US Marines had quite rightly been preparing themselves to do, where he exploited the ability to refuel helicopters by air, the long-range capability of the helicopters, and the ability to rapidly deploy not just Marine infantry, but also light armored vehicles and attack helicopters, and also to keep it all sustained by air through US Air Force C-17s, for example, bringing in bulldozers. And I think that is one of the most imaginative amphibious operations there's ever been. In the book, I do wonder if the imagination of Brigadier General Mattis and also the US fleet commander in Bahrain who conceived of the idea, if that was slightly failed by our sense unwillingness to then use the Marines to contribute to the isolation of the battlefield in Tora Bora, which may have been a lost opportunity to help prevent the escape of Osama bin Laden.
Let me ask you two of the toughest questions, which we've saved for the end. Trump administration is driving to withdraw from Afghanistan as quickly as possible, and there are accusations that it's haphazard, that the troop reduction isn't tied to progress with the Taliban. And in fact, the Taliban have not been negotiating in good faith, and we've cut out our Kabul partners on most of these deliberations. What are the implications of a premature or ill-considered withdrawal, whether it's from Afghanistan or from Iraq, as we saw with the Trump administration in Syria last year?
It strikes me the Trump administration is pretty much out of Iraq, and it's pretty much out of an Iraq where Iran has achieved much greater political influence and also economic investment than before 2001. But going on to Afghanistan, I think the US and NATO withdrawal from Afghanistan increases the advantage the Taliban has. It seems to me the military capability of the Afghan government is reducing and will reduce as US counter-terrorist intelligence and air assets exit the country. The political credibility of the Afghan government is reducing as well. And I think the balance of advantage is shifting to the Taliban. A rapid withdrawal of US troops from Afghanistan would, in my view, accelerate this.
And ultimately, Ben, what's been gained after spending, just on the part of the United States, more than $3 trillion, thousands of dead American service members, tens and countless thousands Iraqi dead, and tens of thousands, many tens of thousands wounded here. And that doesn't even include the contribution of our allies and partners who gave up a generation of modernization. I think sometimes people in Washington don't recognize the enormous shifts in investment all of our NATO partners had to make to field the kind of capabilities that were demanded of the commitment we demanded from them over two decades, ultimately. I mean, at the end of all of this, what do we have to show for it?
Sometimes when I've been writing this, I felt like I've been writing a history of the German army in the Second World War, which after some amazing victories, lost. And it lost because of poor strategy. But I think, you know, there are some silver linings to the cloud. Let's be quite clear that Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and globally was very badly damaged and has not staged a serious recovery, even though part of it morphed and split and became ISIS. But much of that damage to Al-Qaeda was a result not so much of Iraq and Afghanistan, but the US, particularly the CIA, leading an international coalition of intelligence agencies and law enforcement against Al-Qaeda. And of course, the killing of Osama bin Laden, in a sense, was an enormous strategic victory, even though it was a victory sort of at arm's length from the campaign in Afghanistan. I think there are two other silver linings to the cloud. One is that the forces of the UK, the US, and many of their allies now have a whole generation of people who prove themselves in combat, who know their business, and who aren't afraid to march to the sound of the guns and the medals on people's chests on Veterans Day and Remembrance Sunday. You know, a physical witness to this. So nobody who's contemplating taking on the US and its allies should be in any doubt that their servicemen can fight. I think it's also the case that in many countries, servicewomen came of age, and it's no coincidence that both the US and UK removed all barriers on the role of women in combat in all three armed forces. I think also there's been a remarkable revolution in battlefield medicine. And this is one of the topics that I regret not covering in sufficient detail in the book. But remarkable numbers of wounded people survived who would not have survived. And I think some of the medical tactics and capabilities will cross over into emergency paramedicine. The medical organizations of the military are much more capable than they ever were. So ending on a high note, I hope.
You know, you talked about the combat experience at the end of the day, and that's absolutely true. But increasingly, people around the world are looking at the great powers that were involved in these wars, whether it's the United States, whether it's the United Kingdom or France or Germany to a lesser degree because it's done a better job on COVID, but see their abject failure in the face of controlling the virus and the sheer number of casualties and some of the political and societal pressures on not wearing a mask and I will not lock down and all of that, and drawing the conclusion that if these people can't, if these populations won't follow orders or government direction to save their lives, how on earth are we going to fight and win a war against China or Russia, for example, right? Which is as much about the capability as it is will and national unity. How do you square that? And is that something that's of concern? Because it's a level of unruliness, Ben, that an American population of World War II or a British population would have been unheard of.
In countries that seem to have had leaders and governments that haven't measured up to COVID, many of the pathologies that those governments appear to have displayed seem very similar to some of the pathologies of inadequate strategic leadership displayed in Washington and London in the early stages of the Iraq and Afghan wars. There's no doubt that Iraq and Afghanistan have shown the crucial importance of leadership at government level and making hard decisions under pressure of time with imperfect information. And both wars are full of examples of people who did it badly and got it right. We've seen similar examples from COVID. So governments should have had wake-up calls about the crucial importance of strategic leadership and strategic decision-making under pressure.
And isn't fundamentally the biggest issue time, Ben, right? I mean, in Afghanistan, for example, because we didn't do what we should have done when we should have done it, the conflict sort of languished until the surge of 2009 and 2010, by which point you could argue it may have been too late to be able to claw back that. I mean, isn't time really the number one factor that we've been getting wrong in many of these things?
Well, you could say there's a parallel with COVID here in that many Asian countries were able to react sufficiently quickly that they're able to suppress the outbreak and haven't had to deal with the terrible cumulative effects that the UK, many European countries, US have had to deal with it. I think strategic decision makers need to know that when time is short, they've got to make hard decisions quickly, but where they're looking at events that have a longer tempo, they need to take their time. And I'll give you two positive examples in the United States. You know, I think the decision-making, President Bush, Secretary Rumsfeld, the CIA director, CENTCOM, and the Special Forces Group concerned and the US Air Force, the decision-making that delivered within a month of 9/11, that very innovative combined campaign with air power, CIA, SOF, and the Northern Alliance. That was rapid decision-making done really well and a leap into the unknown. But, you know, it turned out better than anyone, I think, it expected. Very quick decision-making under pressure. Deliberate decision-making. In the book, I use the example, which has been well reported in various memoirs, of President Obama's very deliberative style of decision-making before he authorized his Afghan surge. And I'm pleased to say that what I said in the book has been borne out by what Obama himself says in his recently published memoirs. He adopted a very deliberate process, the process being adopted in the British government for Iraq and Afghanistan. It may have been deliberative, but it was so ad hoc, it was very suboptimal.
Ben, thanks very much for joining us. It's always an honor and pleasure talking to you. Hope you and yours have a very, very happy Christmas, very Merry New Year, and look forward to having you back on again next year. Thanks so very much.
And all the best to you and your excellent team, Vargo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.